I'm Adrian Finnegan, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, world leaders are pushing for fundamental reform of the World Bank. Ajay Banga is poised to be the institution's new president in the coming weeks, but will Biden's pick fix it? Also this week, from a global shortage to a glut, Samsung is cutting production of semiconductors after profits plunged by 96%. Plus, Nigeria's cash crunch is slowly easing, but the government's attempt to promote a cashless society has hurt businesses and the economy. For nearly 80 years, the World Bank says that its main goals have been to fight poverty and promote global prosperity. But now, a growing number of world leaders are pushing for what they call a 21st century overhaul of the institution to address global warming. That's being led by the leader of one of the world's smallest nations, the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley. The job of leading that reform is now almost certain to fall to Ajay Banga. He's the first Indian-born nominee to the role of World Bank president. Banga is currently serving as vice chairman of the private equity firm General Atlantic, where he sits on the advisory board of its $3.5 billion climate fund. He has more than 30 years of business experience, having served in various roles at MasterCard and the boards of the American Red Cross, among others. Banga has also worked with the White House as co-chair of the Partnership for Central America, an initiative aimed at increasing private sector investment in the region to try to stem the flow of migrants to the US. He was nominated by President Joe Biden in February. There were no other publicly declared candidates when nominations closed in late March. Well, the bank's president is traditionally an American, nominated by the United States, the organization's largest shareholder. If officially approved by the World Bank's board of directors, Banga will replace David Malpass, who's stepping down nearly a year before his five-year term was due to expire. Malpass was publicly rebuked by the White House after he said he didn't know if fossil fuels were driving climate change, remarks for which he later apologized. Well, revamping the institution was top of the agenda at the World Bank and International Monetary Fund's spring meetings this week. The bank has set out its own vision for transformation and to increase its lending capacity in response to calls for action from the United States and other nations. Barbadian Prime Minister Mia Mottley proposed a large-scale reform of the global financial architecture known as the Bridgetown Initiative last year. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Scott Morris. He's the director of U.S. Development Policy Initiative and senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. Scott, good to have you with us. What do you make of the proposed reforms so far, and are they really necessary?
So I think the reforms at the World Bank are certainly necessary, and driving this is a desire, twofold desire, really, to meet what are really pressing development needs across the developing world alongside addressing the climate finance agenda. The World Bank is seen as the leading institution to provide all of this sort of financing. And yet, in terms of its current capacity, it's really not up to the task. So I think the desire for the reform is there and the case for it is there at the moment.
Of course, at the center of these reforms will be Ajay Banga. Is he the right man for the job?
I think he's certainly an interesting pick, and I think what it demonstrates, this is the U.S. nominee for the World Bank presidency. There are no other challengers, so we fully expect that he will be the next president. And I think what he demonstrates is the desire of the U.S. and presumably other shareholders to have someone who can steer a large organization, 15,000 employees, and really deliver this financing. So, you know, he is not a climate advocate per se. He doesn't come from the NGO community. He's a businessman. He has experience running a large company, and he has experience with the numbers. And I think that's really where the focus is right now. How do we deliver much bigger financing numbers to meet climate needs, to meet pressing development needs for these countries?
Can Banga do that within existing resources, especially as the US at the moment is resisting any capital increase to add to the bank's coffers?
Well, I think this is the challenge as we speak this week, and the governors of the bank have met. As you say, they really are only considering measures that would attempt to stretch existing capital. And I think this is inevitably going to be a disappointment. There's only so far you can go. And in fact, what they have offered so far in their discussions are very modest increases and certainly not up to the level of ambition of their own rhetoric. So I think almost inevitably they will be considering new capital down the road. I think it would be better if they were already having that kind of discussion today, but it hasn't been the case so far, and I think that's a disappointment.
Many poorer nations are concerned that if the bank changes its focus towards climate change and away from its anti-poverty mission, they may suffer. Are they right to be concerned?
Well, I think there are two aspects to their concerns. One is that is money going to be taken away from them for a different group of countries where the climate needs are more pressing? So the poorest countries, they're not the source of big emissions. Those tend to be the wealthier developing countries. So those poor countries do have concerns about how big the pie is going to be. And, this comes back to the overall financing issue. If it's a bigger pot of money, that can allay their concerns. The other concern I think they have is in their own programming with the World Bank, they don't want to be overly constrained about how they use the money. And by the way, for the most part, they are borrowing this money. It is on favorable terms, but they do have to pay it back. So they rightly have strong views about how they are using it and how constrained they might be in using it. So if their priority is education or health, they don't necessarily want to be steered away from those programs in favor of clean energy, for example.
The bank, in loaning to these countries, is stretching its own resources, loosening those restrictions to provide more money to low-income countries to fight climate change, could be problematic, couldn't it? I mean, can it do so without affecting its top-tier credit ratings?
I think if anything, they're being overly cautious and sensitive to the credit rating. I think by now there's a pretty clear consensus among the bank's owners, the shareholder countries, that they do want to protect that credit rating, this sterling AAA credit rating. And as a result, I think these measures that seek to stretch the balance sheet are very modest. And there's obviously a trade-off there. I think they've already made their decision about which way they want to lean, which does take us back to the importance of fresh capital, that there's only so far they are willing to go to test the risk tolerance of their shareholders. And anything close to jeopardizing that AAA is clearly off the table at this point.
This reform was proposed by or inspired by the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley. She wants the World Bank to pursue an expansionist reform agenda. Do you think her plans will be fully adopted?
I think the desire is to match the ambition of her plans. I think in the details we won't necessarily see all that she has been talking about, which, by the way, extends beyond the World Bank. It includes the IMF. So I think there are different elements of her plan. But in terms of where we are today, I have to say, frankly, I don't think the World Bank is there yet in delivering that level of ambition.
Good to talk to you, Scott. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
My pleasure.
An increase in demand for electronics during coronavirus lockdowns triggered a shortage in semiconductors, which are an important element of tablets, smartphones, and, of course, cars. But sales have dropped since restrictions were lifted. Many manufacturers are now struggling with a surplus in supply and a drop in the demand. The world's biggest chipmaker, Samsung, has joined its competitors in cutting production. The company has flagged a 96% reduction in quarterly operating profit, the lowest in 14 years. The chipmaker's decision is a rare move after resisting pressure to reduce production. Just last month, Samsung announced that it plans to invest billions of dollars over 20 years to develop a mega semiconductor hub in South Korea. Joining us from Seattle City in Washington State is Alex Capri, research fellow at the Heinrich Foundation and lecturer at the NUS Business School. Good to have you with us, Alex. What do you make of Samsung's announcement? How significant is it?
Well, it's very important because it reflects much broader trends, and you mentioned them in your introduction, and that is that COVID really produced a surge in demand because of the demand for extra laptops and cell phones and wireless technology and so forth. And as we come out of the COVID stretch in the global economy, we are seeing that demand has gone down. There's been, on the flip side, a glut of chips, and you know, we have other companies cutting production. So at some point, we're going to see the price of chips stabilize as production is cut and as, you know, prices normalize. And I think that'll probably happen in the next maybe 8 months or so. We'll see that happening. But there are other factors contributing to this as well. You have the Ukraine war, which has injected uncertainty. And of course, with sanctions applying to dual-use goods, of which you know, we know semiconductors are part of that zone of goods in the economy, if you will. And then, of course, there's inflation. You know, as consumers look to figure out how to cope with rising costs in food, in energy, they're spending less on consumer electronics. So again, I think this is part of a perfect storm in the global economy that, you know, barring any kind of catastrophic events in the next 8 to 12 months, I think will probably pan out.
You say that the prices will eventually stabilize. Is that going to be enough to clear the glut? And how long before that happens?
Yeah. So the glut, when we look at the range, if you will, of chips that are out in the market now, and we put them in different categories or buckets. Many of them are, as I said, tied to consumer electronics. But I think as electric vehicles begin to come online, as you see, you know, green infrastructure projects in the United States, in the EU, as we see those beginning to get more traction, there will be more demand for certain sectors of legacy chips that will, you know, number one, they'll get soaked up, they'll get used up, whatever's on supply. But then there will be this evolution in the marketplace with chips that will apply to these very specific industries. I mentioned electric vehicles. There's medical technologies. There's other types of clean tech. And I think as we move forward, again, barring any kind of catastrophic events in the global economy, these niches within these new industries are going to begin to demand a steady supply of these chips. And right now, there's no equilibrium in the markets. There's a lot of uncertainty, and, you know, we've got this glut, but eventually that's going to work itself out.
What are the implications of all of this for the U.S. Semiconductor manufacturing industry in particular? After Joe Biden announced the CHIPS Act, which was meant to boost production in the U.S.
So the CHIPS Act is a mid to a long-term sort of glide pattern, if you will. We can expect a lot of government stimulus. So regardless of what the market's doing, because there are geopolitical incentives behind chips, there are climate change incentives. There are reasons to regionalize and localize, not just chips in the U.S., but, you know, chips in Europe, chips in Korea, and so on. There are reasons to continue to localize and regionalize. And so the markets are not going to operate purely on, you know, market dynamics. There's going to be a lot of industrial policy. There's going to be a lot of Keynesian economic stimuli, if you will. And so we can expect that to play a role in the United States, in the chip market. The other thing that's going to play out in the chip market everywhere and that's going to ultimately affect productivity, is a dearth, if you will, of talent, right? There just simply aren't enough engineers anywhere in the world to meet the demand of 2030, where we're going to see the chip industry, you know, being worth $1 trillion. And there's just so much demand everywhere. So that's going to be a major factor that's going to play into the markets. And so we're going to have to consider all of that.
Thanks for that, Alex. Really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Okay, Adrian, my pleasure.
A redesign of Nigeria's currency, as well as a recall of old banknotes, has triggered a cash shortage in Africa's largest economy. The situation is slowly improving now that the central bank has extended the deadline to stop using the old notes until the end of the year. But for many in rural areas where digital payment services just aren't reliable and fewer than half the people there have a bank account, the changes are still causing chaos. Victoria Gatenby reports.
Shehu Umar blames the government for the near collapse of his business. With not enough new banknotes in circulation, he's struggling to find buyers for his goods.
It's difficult to feed my family. As we speak, I only have 50 cents in the shop. I don't even have enough to give the shop assistant money to catch a bus home.
In October last year, Nigeria's central bank announced the redesign of the highest denominations of its currency, the Naira, introducing more security features. The bank then took more than three quarters of the banknotes out of circulation to discourage their use. 6 months on, and some Nigerians are still queuing at banks for the new notes to ensure they don't lose their savings. But there has been some relief since the Supreme Court ordered the central bank to put the old notes back into circulation until the end of the year.
The Supreme Court order, I think it's going to bring, is bringing relief to many Nigerians, as we can see now that there's been, you know, quite easy access to cash in different parts of the country, even though in some places there's still a bit of a queue. But I think over time, you know, in the next couple of months, we should see a case where things will improve.
An estimated 100 million Nigerians lack access to banking services, which is worsening the problem. Most of them live in rural areas. They stand to lose some or all of their savings when the deadline expires. And economists say if that happens, it'll lead to more hardship in a country where 60% of the population lives in poverty.
Once the economy is experiencing this, it simply means that the economy can collapse at any time. And then before you ginger people to production again, it will take time, because that trust on government and its policies is no longer there.
Despite the central bank's extension, the cash crunch continues, and it's causing economic pain to millions of Nigerians and small businesses. Victoria Gatenby for Counting the Cost.
Joining us now from London, Razia Khan, who is the Managing Director and Chief Economist of Africa and Middle East Global Research at Standard Chartered Bank. Good to have you with us, Razia. What is the situation in Nigeria right now? Has this cash crisis eased at all?
Well, what we've seen since the Supreme Court ruling that the old notes will continue to be legal tender until the end of the year has been a slight easing of the pressures that had been experienced earlier on. But we shouldn't imagine that things have necessarily gone back to normal. The CBN, the Central Bank of Nigeria, had hoped that this would kickstart the whole process of much deeper financial inclusion, the adoption of digital channels for money transfer, and in the process of a rather ambitious timetable being outlined, many more of the old notes have been destroyed than new notes have been printed. So in that sense, although there has been some easing of the pressures, it's by no means back to the situation before the Naira notes exchange.
Why were the new notes introduced in the first place? I mean, I thought Nigeria was trying to prepare for a cashless society.
Well, Nigeria has long had ambitions to try to reduce the reliance on cash. It is very expensive. It adds to the informality of economic activity, which in itself gives rise to a whole host of different economic issues. Nigeria has one of the lowest rates of revenue mobilization, that is, the amount that it's able to collect in taxes as a percentage of its GDP, as a proportion of all of the economic activity that takes place. And a lot of that stems from the economic informality of the country, that it's very difficult to formalize the informal economy, especially with this reliance on cash. So in a sense, the move towards a more cashless society, it has been tried, attempted in the past. The hope was that this would help a great deal with the formalization of the economy. There are also concerns, of course, around the legality of a lot of the transactions that take place in a largely cash-based economy, whether this has to do with transactions over the parallel foreign exchange market in Nigeria, rather than through official channels, whether it could be directly linked to the incidence of crime and the incidence of kidnapping in the country. There are many good reasons over the long term for Nigeria to move away from its significant reliance on cash in favor of e-channels. However, the issue this time around was probably the scale of the ambition, the very, very short timeline provided for these changes to take place, for the new Naira notes exchange to happen.
All of this must have dented people's confidence in the country's banking and financial system. I mean, can that trust be restored? What would it take?
Well, it came at a very difficult time for Nigeria because it compounded a number of economic difficulties that people already had to contend with. This was a time with very little availability of fuel. Fuel, which is widely subsidized in Nigeria, was not necessarily available at the subsidized price. People were having to face high rates of inflation of over 20%, driven by food inflation and then compounded by additional fuel inflation because fuel was not available at the subsidized price. When you overlay on that significant economic hardship, the extent of the cash crunch that people experienced simply because they were not able to obtain the new notes in time to replace the old notes, the pace at which the old notes were being withdrawn from the economy far exceeded the availability of the new notes. So timing had a lot to do with it. This was not ideal, given that there were other challenges being faced in the economy, but also, again, the very short time frame provided to try to oversee this rather ambitious exercise in an economy of perhaps close to 200 million people. We'll soon find out with the next census. But of course, the reach of the banking system, the ability of ordinary people to approach banks to be able to obtain the new Naira notes, which had been in short supply anyway, the miscalculation perhaps was the amount that would be needed to be able to ease transaction activity in an economy like Nigeria, still, despite all efforts, largely dependent on cash.
And what does all of this mean for the president-elect and his plans to revamp Nigeria's economy?
There is an expectation that come June 2023, we're not too far away, the fuel subsidy issue will have to be addressed. Whether it's done all in one go or whether it's done through a gradual removal of the subsidy, we'll have to wait to see. But of course, looking at the economic backdrop, looking at the kind of challenges that people have faced in the run-up to that subsidy removal is going to be a very important part of this. If it comes in the context of an already inflationary environment where a lot of pricing of imported goods tend to reflect what's happening on the parallel FX market in Nigeria, if it happens against the backdrop of the persistent effects of the cash shortage that has interfered with the ease of transactions in Nigeria, that's not ideal, but no one doubts that the fuel subsidy removal is a reform that Nigeria needs. The new administration, the incoming administration, has pledged that it will adhere to its removal, and therefore the expectation must be that that fuel subsidy will go.
Razia, really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Get in touch with us if you'd like to comment on anything that you've seen. You can tweet me. I'm at A. Finnegan. Please use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or you can drop us a line. Counting the cost at aljazeera.net is our email address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page, and there you'll find individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.